Hello, this is Linda Lover, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from today's issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Scattered and dispersed, city clears Kensington Church encampment after Toronto fire order. The City of Toronto, accompanied by police and security guards, cleared an encampment outside the Church of St. Stephen in the Fields near College and Augusta Streets on Thursday after a fire hazard order from the fire department. The church and the city received the order from Toronto Fire Services on Tuesday to remove combustible materials from public and private property at 103 Bellevue Avenue by 1 p.m. Thursday. Toronto Fire told the Star in an email the site had increasingly accumulated combustible materials and ignition sources, resulting in elevated fire and life safety risk that require immediate action to mitigate the fire safety risk. As of Wednesday, 12 people remained at the Kensington neighborhood encampment. On Thursday, city outreach workers offered shelter spaces and homelessness supports to residents, a spokesperson for the city told the Star. No encampment residents resisted. While some agreed to move to a shelter, Reverend Maggie Helwig, who received the order from the Provincial Fire Marshal's office, said the residents were coerced into doing so and had no choice because they were threatened with having their homes torn down. People are just being scattered and dispersed and torn away from community and torn away from support, and that makes people more traumatized and makes everything more difficult, she said. City spokesperson Elise Van Schiel told the Star there had been three fires at the encampment this year and that the accumulation of debris was such that if a fire broke out, people wouldn't be able to get out fast enough. People's health and safety really is at risk, Van Schiel said. That's the call that Toronto Fire has made. And so at that point, we have an obligation, she said, adding the order meant the city had to speed up the process. The city used heavy machinery to clear the site and then on Thursday evening began placing concrete blocks where the encampment had been. An encampment at Dufferin Grove Park was also cleared with construction equipment last month, and arrests were made when people returned this month. The Dufferin Grove encampment was taken down after months of city staff offering shelter spaces to those residents, and for some, housing. At the Kensington site, residents and church members had been organizing and removing belongings since at least 8:30 a.m., and by 2 p.m., church members confirmed to city staff that there were no residents left on site. The church stored items residents asked them to hold on to, suitcases, bags of clothes, and miscellaneous items, like a lacrosse stick and a toolbox, but most of their things remained outside. About 50 observers watched from the sidewalk of the church on the north end of Kensington Market, including encampment supporters, church workers and volunteers, passerby, and media. Earlier in the day, Sedalia Da Silva, who said she works in the area, expressed some relief at city staff and residents clearing the encampment, calling it an eyesore that had been there for years. Other passerby heckled police and city staff, while some shouted, "Shame on you, and these are my neighbors you're evicting." The site had been home to the encampment for years, although the city partially cleared it in 2023. Helwig said the church would have faced hefty fines from the fire marshal if they hadn't complied with the order, but added the church won't turn away anyone who returns. "If people come to us for help, we do not send them away," she said. That is a basic position of the church. On Wednesday night, the city awarded Helwig with the 2025 Toronto Book Award and a $20,000 prize for her book, Encampment, Resistance, Grace, and an Unhoused Community. Don Orovec, a juror for the award who observed the encampment Thursday, said Helwig's book has a powerful message for Toronto and how it deals or fails to deal with homelessness. They bulldoze these places, but they don't have a plan for how to house them, how to take care of them, Oravec said. These are people, in some cases, that are mentally unwell, and I think it's cruel not to come up with a solution to this problem. I mean, we're one of the richest countries on the planet, and we can't solve this problem. Something doesn't feel right to me. Quayside site to host urban forest. Green space at former Sidewalk Labs location designed to draw native species. An emerging neighborhood along Toronto's eastern waterfront that was once synonymous with futuristic smart city goals like garbage clearing robots is now being designed around a completely different vision, an urban forest. In plans presented to a design review panel in September, the new vision for Quayside, the location of Google sister company Sidewalk Labs' abandoned plans for a high-tech neighborhood, is anchored around dense urban green space. The planned expanse of native flora like sugar maples and yellow birch, including some younger trees and more mature growths, is set to be built on top of the neighborhood's parking structure. Copenhagen-based design studio SLA says the goal of the community forest is to mimic Toronto's ravines and their Carolinian trees between Quayside's new residential buildings, with their success at least partly measured by how many species of birds, bats, bees, and more flock to the new green space. SLA's Rasmus Astrup admits this isn't going to be easy. They're planning their forest near whizzing traffic atop concrete instead of deep earth and need to consider the resilience of each tree and shrub planted on site. But he sees the payoff as transformative. Imagine it's a hot day. You're crossing a parking lot. It's heating up. You're sweating. It's horrible. But if you are comfortable walking under the shade of the trees, birds are singing, it's just nice and crisp and green everywhere, you relax, your shoulders fall down, and you just have more likelihood of looking into the eyes of your neighbor and saying hi, Astrup said. Chris Glazek, Chief Planning and Design Officer for Waterfront Toronto, says the idea is to create something different from other green pockets downtown, such as the waterfront's music garden. It will not be as manicured. It's going to feel more natural, maybe a bit like some of the landscapes that we just built in Besiege Park along the banks of the New River, but probably a little bit denser, he said. Glasek knows that Toronto development sometimes falls short of glossy renderings promising dense tree cover. A key problem is that, in an effort to keep costs low, not enough soil is used to support bigger trees, Glasek said. In this case, they also have to think about structural supports for the roof of the parking garage to make sure the weight of the forest isn't a problem. That's something we really have to work with our development partners to make sure that we get all the right conditions. Very often, that's one of the places where they fall short, he said. Astrup is confident that they can make that happen, citing his team's experience on projects with similar features, such as a lower-budget project in Copenhagen. That project transformed a concrete roof terrace on a student housing complex into a 160-meter-long green space with areas carved out for study spaces, lawns, greenhouses, and more. Monitoring new species attracted to the project is about more than ensuring pleasant bird sounds. Astrup noted that many of their targeted species are pollinators for the new plants. I can't promise what we can do here, but I can tell you that we've done monitoring of Danish projects many times, and we have one project where we got 122 new species after 1 year, he said. In Quayside, SLA is hoping to see native species such as northern cardinals, warblers, big brown bats, hummingbirds, and brown-belted bumblebees. Their team has narrowed their planting list to only resilient flora, Astrup added, including shagbark hickories, black gum trees, and eastern white pines, along with lower growing plants such as wild strawberries, Christmas ferns, and milkweed. Each one will be planted in specific locations based on factors like sunlight and wind, Ostrup said. Their team knows nurseries that will sell them larger trees, he said, and their plan is to ask for one that might not normally sell, ones with wonky, curved trunks as opposed to straight lines, which he sees as creating a more organic feeling than a manicured park. The forest idea has influenced the design of the new residential buildings as well, with Henning Larsen architects Michael Sorensen telling the Star they'd aimed for deliberately compact podiums to maximize the green space. At street level, the experience will be unlike anything else in the area, he said. University of Toronto housing and community development expert David Holchansky sees creating a pocket of green space as generally more feasible than the plans advanced under the Sidewalk Lab's proposal, and a plan that could offer tangible benefits to future residents. He pointed to David Crombie Park, built decades ago near St. Lawrence Market. That park, which SLA has also been tapped to revitalize, was a good addition as the area transformed from an industrial hub to a residential neighborhood, Holchansky said. It had enough space for activities for different age groups, whether it's seniors sitting or toddlers in a playground or teenagers with basketball. Creating an urban forest in Coyside could also ensure continued public access to the city's lakefront, he said. Glasic says the first three buildings in Quayside will hem in the forest from three sides. The fourth side is the future Phase 2 construction site. Until that's built, the plan is to fence off that end of the property and conceal the fence with foliage. The hope is to break ground on the sprawling project in 2026, Glasic said, with the first residents moving in by early 2031. Carney rejects calls to hit back on tariffs. Prime Minister cites intensive trade talks with Trump. Prime Minister Mark Carney has rejected Premier Doug Ford's call to revive retaliatory counter-tariffs against the United States, citing sensitive negotiations with U.S. President Donald Trump aimed at securing tariff relief for the steel, aluminum, and energy sectors. There is times to hit back, and there is times to talk. And right now is the time to talk, the Prime Minister said Thursday. Speaking in Toronto hours before visiting Ford's home, Carney said it's the wrong time to revive counter-tariffs because right now with the Americans, we're engaged in deep negotiations, intensive negotiations, on several sectors of the Canadian economy, energy, aluminum, and the steel sector. But those talks showed no public sign of progress as Canada-U.S. Trade Minister Dominic LeBlanc and Carney's top public servant, Michael Sabia, remained in Washington Thursday evening. LeBlanc's office declined to comment on any of his meetings this week in the U.S. Capitol. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith applauded Carney's very pragmatic approach to the U.S. negotiations. I see what the Prime Minister has done in talking about pipeline, steel, and aluminum together, Smith told reporters Thursday. That's a way for us to be able to get tariffs lifted from steel and aluminum by promising to sell the Americans more heavy oil. I think that's a pretty good arrangement. Carney's government has acknowledged discussions with Trump about the KXL pipeline expansion project, which was supported by the U.S. president in his first term, only to be killed by Joe Biden, and would allow an existing Keystone pipeline to ship more Canadian crude oil to U.S. Gulf Coast refineries. But the prime minister, his frontline ministers, and senior advisors have refused to discuss exactly what is on the table. Carney reiterated Canada is in a relatively better position than any other U.S. trading partner when it comes to most tariffs. That's due to Trump's exemption from his 35% so-called border emergency tariffs for Canadian-produced goods that comply with North American or American content rules. Canadian energy and potash products that don't comply with Canadian-United States-Mexico agreement, known as the CUSMA, CUSMA, rules a foreign face a lesser 10% border emergency tariff. Canada, like other countries, continues to face punishing 50% U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum shipments, 25% tariffs on auto and auto parts that are not U.S. made, along with a range of other sector-specific tariffs, including 45% on lumber products, 50% on copper, and 25% on wooden cabinets, furniture, and heavy trucks. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. LeBlanc and Sabia continued talks this week that began after Carney's trip to Washington last week. Their efforts are aimed at side agreements on key sectors ahead of what's expected to be a more complex trade negotiation under next year's CUSMA review. Ahead of his one-hour sit-down with Ford, Carney underscored that the bulk of the steel sector is right here in Ontario, and we want to make progress in those negotiations. Premier Ford and I are both interested in results for, in my case, for workers and families across Canada, of course, in his case, for the province of Ontario, and we're looking to work to those ends as constructively as possible, Carney said. In a catch-all statement on X after they met, Carney said he and Ford talked about major projects built, our government's plan to toughen bail and sentencing laws, and our measures to support workers and industries affected by tariffs, and thanked the Ontario Premier for his partnership. Speaking to reporters in Kenora a day earlier, Ford had said he would continue to urge the Prime Minister to retaliate. That guy, President Trump, is a real piece of work. What my message to the Prime Minister when I meet him on Thursday is, if you can't get a deal, let's start hitting him back, the Ontario Premier said. Let's start hitting the U.S. back hard, because all Trump does is continue with tariffs. We're nice, 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 play nice in the sandbox. I'm sick and tired of sitting and rolling over. We need to fight back, said Ford. We buy $356 billion of goods, Canada does, off the U.S. annually. We're the number one customer to the U.S. No one in the world buys more goods than what we do. We need to start hitting back and hitting hard. That's the only thing this person understands, he said. But Carney underscored how sensitive the broader trade discussions are with both the U.S. and China as he turned aside a question about whether Canada should cast its lot with China and not the U.S., given Beijing's offer to drop Chinese tariffs on Canadian canola and other products if Ottawa agreed to drop 100% tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles. In the fall of 2024, before Trump's election, Canada imposed a 100% tariff on Chinese EVs to match the Biden administration's move, as well as new tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. As Canada tries to re-engage with China after a seven-year gap in the leader-to-leader talks, Carney said he is looking at a much broader range of issues than single sectors and single trades. And when we look at the auto sector, we take into account the dynamics with the United States, the ongoing negotiations there, and what the potential impact is. It's naive to take a relationship that is broader and can broaden and to boil it down to two things that go across borders, he said. It's a deeper set of conversations that are going on. It's not that simple, and nor is the relationship in the auto sector that simple as just open a door here with China with no impact on the relationship with the United States and the impact on activity here in Canada. Carney was to brief Ford on the status of the latest Canada-U.S. talks, adding, He'd also talk about the auto, forestry, and other manufacturing sectors and what will make the biggest difference, not just to those sectors, but to all of Ontario, all of Canada, which is where we end up, following the review of the Canada-US-Mexico trade agreement, which is coming very shortly. So the strategy has to take all of that into account and deliver the results. Thousands of users wait years to borrow audiobook. Queue for rare, unabridged copies of Bill Bryson novel. Welcome and congratulations. I am delighted that you could make it. More than 2,000 Toronto Public Library users, known as the TPL, are waiting to hear those words from the first page of A Short History of Nearly Everything, written by Bill Bryson. As of Thursday, it has the longest audiobook waitlist at TPL, with 2,432 active holds on only 4 copies, a number that continues to climb. In about 18 hours, if you're listening to the unabridged audiobook version, Bryson works across time and space to flush out a history of the Earth from the Big Bang Theory to the rise of civilization. While Audible and Apple Books have a copy of the audiobook narrated by Bryson for sale, TPL holds possibly some of the few, if not the only, unabridged copies of the audiobook, which are read by Richard Matthews in Canada, and they're free with a library membership. Last Friday, the 67th person in the queue was Toronto software developer Nina Azar. She moved up in the queue by 2 people since her post about it on Reddit that day. "I was a teenager when it first came out in 2003, said Azar in the email response. She said she first read the unabridged book about a decade ago and thought it was perfect bedtime reading. On December 3rd, 2019, Azar placed a hold on a TPL copy of the unabridged audiobook. That was almost 6 years ago. About once a year, I look to see if the unabridged version is available on Audible, but it never is," said Azar. She won't settle for the abridged version because the little details and tangents were what made the book so interesting. "I want the full experience. I'm not in a rush, though. I've read the book before, so I'm happy to continue waiting and feeding the stereotype about Torontonians and lines. If Torontonians love to line up, why would an online queue for an audiobook be any different? We are aware of the high wait time for this title, but unfortunately, libraries can't license any additional audiobook copies," wrote Matt Abbott, Senior Manager, Collection Development at TPL, in an email response. According to TPL's website, holds are automatically set to expire 2 years from the date the first request is placed. If you don't renew your hold, you might lose your place in line. Abbott explained the lack of available copies is a result of issues around licensing. Titles that are exclusive to a subscription platform can often become unavailable for libraries to license through OverDrive, a platform which hosts TPL's digital collection of ebooks, audiobooks, and magazines. According to Abbott, licenses can cost anywhere between $65 and $181. Sometimes they expire in just 2 years, so the library has to purchase another. Abbott said audiobook copies of A Short History are simply unavailable for libraries to license at this time. Azar has done some math. She said if the 66 people ahead of her each keep the audiobook for 2 weeks instead of the 3 allotted by TPL, for hold, she may receive a copy of A Short History in about 2.5 years. "So with my luck, I'll be listening to it by 2027. When I finally hear the first few words, I'll probably laugh." A revised edition of the book is set to be released on Tuesday. Max brings the heat. Scherzer fires up Blue Jays with strong outing to even up series. They call him Mad Max for a reason. Max Scherzer summoned his younger Hall of Fame self Thursday night in Seattle, putting together his best start in months and his best playoff outing in 6 years. And as a result, the American League Championship Series is guaranteed to go back to Toronto for a Game 6 on Sunday, thanks to an 82 win over the Mariners. 8-2 win. Scherzer came into Game 4 having not pitched in more than 3 weeks after he was left off the Jays roster for the American League Division Series against the New York Yankees. In his final 6 regular season starts, he has allowed 25 runs over 25 innings of work. He'd been scored on in the first inning in each of his last 5 starts. Thursday night, not only was the first inning not an issue, but Scherzer was cruising into the 5th, having allowed just 1 run, a solo homer by Mississauga's Josh Naylor, on 2 hits while the offense built him a 4-run lead. Dominic Canzone led off that 5th inning with a seeing eye single up the middle, but Scherzer retired the next 2 batters, one thanks to a terrific catch by Addison Barger in deep right center, and with Seattle's leadoff hitter Randy Arozarena coming up to the plate for a 3rd time, Jays manager John Schneider hopped out of the dugout and headed to the mound to make a pitching change. It was then that Schneider learned just why they called Scherzer Mad Max. At that point, really, mad was a severe understatement. When Scherzer saw the skipper coming, he turned and screamed, "Whoa!" When Schneider got to the mound, the manager said something, ostensibly checking to see what Scherzer had left, and the pitcher emphatically, "Yeah, I'm sure, let's go." That was enough for Schneider, who headed back to the dugout. Scherzer proceeded to strike out Arozarena to end the inning, his 4th of 5 strikeouts on the night. Scherzer came back out for the 6th and retired the first 2 hitters, but then walked Jorge Polanco. He knew his night was over after throwing 87 pitches. This time, there was no argument. As Schneider approached the mound, Scherzer simply whispered, "Gee, damn it," to himself, then handed the ball over without a fight. To suggest that this performance was unexpected would be a disservice to the word. No one has ever doubted Scherzer's pedigree, his toughness, or the ferocity with which he approaches every pitch. But given how he finished the season, it was more than fair to wonder if the 41-year-old had the stuff or the stamina to give the Jays a chance to win what was their most important game of the season. The doubters were completely silenced Thursday night. "This is his 500th career start," said Schneider before Scherzer's 26th playoff start, the other 474 coming in the regular season. "He's got a pretty good idea of what he's doing. It really comes down to where he's putting his pitches." The leash was expected to be short, with the Jays' season not exactly on the line, but pretty much on the line. After all, a loss would leave them needing 3 wins in a row to escape elimination. But even after Scherzer threw 8 straight balls in the first inning, walking Cal Raleigh after jumping ahead of him 0-10, then walking Julio Rodriguez on 4 pitches, there was no action in the Jays' bullpen. Scherzer escaped that threat by getting Polanco to hit a ground ball up the middle, right where shortstop Andrés Giménez was stationed for an inning-ending double play. No reliever started to warm until Mason Fluharty got up in the 4th. Louis Varland got up in the 5th and was ready to come into the game when Scherzer turned back his manager, and he was right. As much as Shane Bieber's performance in Game 3, he just 2 runs over 6 innings and helping the Jays to get up off the mat in the series was the reason that they traded for the 2020 Cy Young Award winner at the deadline. This start from Scherzer was the reason the Jays signed him to a 1-year deal this past winter. "I've been looking forward to a postseason Max start since we signed him," said Schneider. "I know he has been through ups and downs this year and injuries and good outings and bad. This is literally why he's playing still. He's not to pitch in April, May, June, July. It's to pitch in the postseason. There's one thing on his mind at this point in his career. There's no doubt Schneider loved watching Scherzer spin 5, 2, and 3 terrific innings to knot up his ALCS and turn it into a best of three. He just might not have enjoyed that trip to the mound. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Bail conditions under review. Prime Minister to introduce tough criminal justice bill next week. Prime Minister Mark Carney suggested Thursday his predecessor, Justin Trudeau, had been too lax on crime as he previewed tough criminal justice legislation his government will introduce next week. Flanked by dozens of uniformed RCMP officers, as well as GTA Liberal MPs fresh off an election where crime was top of mind for some voters, Carney said the coming bill will fulfill campaign commitments to introduce reverse onus bail and allow consecutive sentencing for repeat offenders who commit major crimes, including violent auto theft, breaking and entering, human trafficking, and physical and sexual assault. It will also increase penalties for organized retail theft and restrict conditional sentences for some sexual offenses that allowed offenders to serve time with restrictions at home, in a reversal from a Trudeau-era law that aimed to address systemic racism in the justice system. Canadians deserve to feel safe in their community, to know that their homes are secure, to know that their money that they've earned is safe in their own bank account, Carney told reporters outside the RCMP's Toronto Airport detachment, where he also announced a $1.8 billion investment in the federal police force. Criticizing laws that fail repeatedly and make people feel unsafe, Carney took direct aim at bail laws long attacked by conservative premiers like Ontario's Doug Ford, saying it's even worse when you hear that the person who stole that car, broke in that home, or defrauded a loved one has done it many times before and just got released on bail. Right now, in most bail hearings, the starting point is to release, and the Crown must prove why someone should not be released on bail, making it too easy for repeat violent offenders to quickly get back on the street, sometimes back into the same communities that they just committed crimes in, he said, arguing measures from previous governments needed to be changed to protect Canadians. His rhetoric marked a clear shift from the Trudeau era, said criminal defense lawyer Frank Addario, who described it as worrisome escalation and failed tough-on-crime porn. We go through this cycle with Liberal governments on a routine basis. Whenever they feel threatened by the Conservative leadership and that flank, they respond with tough-on-crime rhetoric, which invariably blames judges or laws being incorrectly interpreted, Addario said. There's no real evidence that that's correct. Crime rates seem to be oblivious in Canada and elsewhere in the world to the severity of laws or alternative options that are available to judges. While Carney said his government will also try to tackle the root causes of crime through investments in affordable housing, mental health, and addictions treatment, no other details were provided Thursday, where the focus, as seen on the podium in front of the Prime Minister, was combating crime. Contrasting his vision with that of Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, who has said he would use the Constitution's notwithstanding clause to pass criminal justice reforms, Carney vowed to follow the courts and ensure the legislation withstands constitutional scrutiny. We're very confident the package gets the right balance and does what's necessary. But of course, as a fundamental point on anything, anything, whether it's what I'm announcing today or what we do in 6 months or what have been done previously, if there's a judgment of the Supreme Court that something is illegal, you follow it, he said, laughing. This is Canada. It's a country of the rule of law. Conservative justice critic Larry Brock said Carney's announcement Thursday fell far short of the changes his party wants to see, even if the removal of some conditional sentences is a step in the right direction. Brock said the government still needs to change policies that he says make it too easy for repeat offenders to get out on bail. I think it is a half-baked measure that is not going to make one iota of a difference, he said. Brian Sauve, the president of the National Police Federation, which represents RCMP members, said the prime minister had good talking points, but that the devil will be in the details once the legislation is tabled. He was also happy with Carney's announcement that the November budget will include $1.8 billion over 4 years to allow the RCMP to hire 1,000 new members and raise cadet allowances to $1,000 per week, a campaign commitment from the Liberals. Carney said the intention is to increase the federal police's capacity to combat online fraud, money laundering, online child sexual exploitation, and organized criminal networks that threaten Canada's economic and national security. The Prime Minister also teased an announcement expected Friday that will deal with investments in border security. The Liberals promised during the election campaign to hire and train 1,000 more Canada Border Services Agency officers, but its union has raised doubts about the feasibility of the plan without new or upgraded training facilities. So far, the agency's Montreal area campus, where all officers must undergo an 18-week training course, has the capacity for around 600 trainees per year, the same as the typical level of attrition, said Mark Weber, the national president of the Customs and Immigration Union. Gun laws in spotlight at trial. The accused listened to proceedings with his eyes closed and his mouth open. It appeared that 43-year-old Richard Edwin, whose trial began this week, was heavily medicated with antipsychotic drugs. Certainly projecting as narcotized, someone in need of mental stabilizing, would be fitting when the core substance of the defense is that Edwin should be found not criminally responsible, or NCR, in the shooting deaths of two men he didn't even know within a span of 2 days in downtown Toronto in 2022. An agreed statement of facts reveals that Edwin was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 2010. How then did this individual come to be in legal possession of at least one, maybe not all, of four firearms and a rifle? The judge-only trial has yet to hear when Edwin obtained the guns, but Canada's Firearms Act stipulates that a person is not eligible to possess a firearm or crossbow, prohibited weapon, restricted weapon, prohibited device, ammunition, prohibited ammunition, or cartridge magazines if they have been treated for a mental illness, whether in a hospital, mental institution, psychiatric clinic, or otherwise, and whether or not the person was confined to such a hospital, institute, or clinic that was associated with violence or threatened or attempted violence on the part of the person against any person. Further, the Chief Firearms Office may consider whether an individual's mental health condition makes it undesirable for their safety or the safety of others to possess a firearm. We like to think that Canada has strong laws covering the possession of firearms and other restricted weapons, certainly compared to our American neighbors. It's estimated, as of last year, that there are 398.5 million guns in the U.S. that has well over a population of about 348 million. Yet, here we are, in this generally peaceful country that doesn't worship at the altar of the gun, with a seriously mentally ill man who had firearms coming out of the wazoo. Police discovered them in Edwin Spadina Road apartment after he was arrested on the evening of April 10, 2022. Edwin, on Tuesday, admitted to the killings in court, but pleaded not guilty to two counts of first-degree murder. A headline in the Star the other day claimed that the slayings shocked Toronto because of the apparent randomness and the brazen nature in which the two victims were shot. I don't think anything is shocking anymore in this city. Kartik Vasudev was a 21-year-old who arrived in Canada to study business management. He was walking past the Sherbourne subway station on the afternoon of April 7th when Edwin emerged from the rear of an outdoor staircase and rushed by Vasudev. Without warning or provocation, Edwin then turned around and shot Vasudev in the back multiple times. As Vasudev fell to the ground, Edwin started to jog away, turned around, raised his arms, and fired more shots in the victim's direction. Edwin then boarded a westbound bus, entered the subway at Wellesley Station, exited at Spadina, walked along Bloor Street, stopping to drop some money into a busker's open guitar case. The postmortem showed that Vasudev was shot in the back, left flank, right flank, right lung, right buttock, right side of the chest, lower and left upper leg. On April 9th, 35-year-old Elijah Mahapath disembarked from a bus at Sherbourne and Dundas Street at around 7 p.m. Edwin was on the sidewalk. Court has heard that he pulled a gun from his waistband and with both hands fired multiple times into the back of the unsuspecting Mahapath. Surveillance video captured in graphically crisp imagery Mahapath falling to the ground as he's being shot, Edwin running past. Again, the shooter continued firing. Edwin removed his shirt, stuffing it into a grocery bag, and changed into a pullover. He got on the subway at Queen Street and was home by 8 p.m. Mahapath suffered gunshot wounds to the lower right side of his back, left buttock, and lower side of the back. Nothing in Edwin's behavior suggests that he had fallen prey to disorganized thinking or any other outward indication of mental illness. If his actions appear crazy, it's because most of us would consider the shooting of a stranger on a crowded sidewalk. That particular intersection is always crowded with homeless people receiving services at the All Saints Church Community Center as inherently deranged. But that's not the legal definition of NCR, which means committing an illegal act while suffering from a mental disorder that rendered the person incapable of appreciating the nature and quality of the act or of knowing that it was wrong. Thus, in the weeks to come, court will hear from dueling psychiatrists, an exercise that continually pits expert against expert in what really is a useless undertaking by shrinks for hire. In Ontario, it's almost impossible to get an appointment with a psychiatrist in less than a year. Not enough of them, and a system that basically farms out referrals to community-based care. But there is a well-known cadre of head gurus who will take the stand. On the stand Thursday was Edwin's mother, Carmen Campbell, a retired employee of the city's shelter system who'd had an extensive experience with the homeless and mentally ill. Her son was not homeless as he moved between Toronto and Ottawa, where his father lived. She recalled how Edwin had first begun to show symptoms of agitation and paranoia in his 20s, which led him to nixing college as he planned after graduating from high school. He told me he was hearing voices and at one point had called the police on himself. She was working nights and weekends, though, and didn't see much of her son at all. This was also during COVID, and Campbell spent long periods tending to an elderly aunt in Jamaica. On the few occasions that she visited his apartment, she never went past the front door. In the back of my mind, I was a bit scared, adding, I didn't think he was in his right mind. Campbell was unaware that he allegedly smoked a lot of weed, as suggested by the Crown, Sandra Duffy. "I've never heard that before," Edwin's mother told the court. She was never directly asked if she knew her son was in possession of firearms. She did mention, however, that Edwin had asked her to help him fill out an application for a gun license. She refused, and they didn't discuss it further. A forensic scientist linked both shootings to the same handgun, a semi-automatic pistol registered to Edwin, found in the apartment with the serial number obscured. Does a disordered and deluded mind render a gun serial number obfuscated as described in the agreed statement of facts, or navigate Toronto's TTC system with adept purpose, or drop money into a busker's guitar case? I anticipate a psychiatrist will say yes, and another psychiatrist will say no. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Mother tells trial son was paranoid. Man admits to 2022 killings, but claims he's not criminally responsible due to mental disorder. Carmen Campbell never went too far inside the little dark room in the basement where her son Richard Edmund was staying on his own. He had become more paranoid and would stutter and constantly look around as if someone was following him, she said. When she'd go to his apartment on Spadina Road near Kendall Avenue, she preferred they meet outside, Campbell testified Thursday at Edmund's trial, where he has admitted to shooting two men in random and unprovoked killings in downtown Toronto in 2022, but is claiming he's not criminally responsible due to a mental disorder. I was a little scared to be there by myself because he was acting so paranoid, and I had heard a child had attacked a mother in Scarborough and killed the mother some time ago, Campbell testified. So in the back of my mind, I was a bit scared to go in. Edwin fatally shot 21-year-old international student Kartik Vasudev in the back on April 7, 2022, outside Sherbourne Station as Vasudev walked to work. 2 days later, he shot and killed 35-year-old Elijah Mahapath on the sidewalk in the Dundas Street and Sherbourne Street area. Edwin didn't know either of his victims, and there had been no prior interaction between them before they were killed. The killings and Edwin's movements before and after the incident were caught on surveillance footage. When he was arrested, police found multiple firearms in the Spadina Road apartment, most of them legally owned. Campbell recalled Edwin had asked her just before the COVID-19 pandemic for her help with an application for a firearm license. I said, what do you need that for? I'm not going to fill anything out, she said, under questioning by Edwin's lawyer, Caitlin Matthews. She said they never discussed the matter further. Campbell conceded to having sporadic contact with her son in his adult years. Crown attorney Sandra Duffy suggested during cross-examination that Edwin told the defense's psychiatrist he had been preoccupied by white supremacists and problems relating to anti-black racism. But Campbell said she didn't know that. She also didn't know he was a regular cannabis user until around 2015, something else he had told the psychiatrist. What? Campbell said Thursday in a surprised tone. I've never heard that before. The 43-year-old Edwin watched intently from the prisoner's box with his mouth open as his mother recounted for the court how she noticed some changes in her son's behavior when he was in his 20s. He had become very nervous, agitated, said Campbell, who worked in the city shelter system with people who had mental health issues. Around 2010, Edwin told his mother he had been hearing voices and that he'd called the police. She took him to someone she identified as not only a medical doctor, but he could see in the spirit if someone had a spiritual issue. The doctor gave Edwin a prescription that Campbell believes was for antipsychotic medication, but which Edwin never filled out. She also took Edwin to a naturopathic doctor because he was very thin and looked sick, and the naturopath gave him some herbs. She said she later found out that he'd been diagnosed with schizophrenia by a doctor in Ottawa. Campbell learned at some point that Edwin was making some money by selling newsletters or stuff like that on the street, and that he'd also created his own newspaper and would solicit donations for it. And she recalled an instance where he had come to visit her at her Toronto apartment and wanted to go out on her balcony. I was very scared because in my mind I'm thinking, what if he goes out there and jumps over or something, she testified. I just pray that he comes in fast, but there was no incident. Ultimately, Campbell never dug too deep into her son's behavioral changes. I had a fear that maybe if I pry, he would get angry at me, she said. The families of Edwin's victims were also listening closely to Campbell's testimony Thursday, including Vasudev's parents who traveled from India and members of Mahapath's family who spoke publicly about him for the first time. Elijah was one of the greatest guys you could find and very intelligent. He was always studying. At school, they were all impressed with him. His aunt, Monica Gonsalves, told reporters Thursday. Mahapath had come from Trinidad and Tobago to live with Gonsalves at the age of 14, along with his siblings. Elijah went shopping and was going home to his apartment, and somebody just shot him in the back, said Gonsalves, who doesn't believe that Edwin is not criminally responsible. I hope the court considers all the evidence and justice will prevail. Vasudev's family described him in 2022 as a polite, sensitive, and very loyal child who was fulfilling his dream of coming to Canada to study business management. Psychiatrists for the defense and Crown who assessed Edwin are expected to testify in the coming weeks. If Superior Court Justice Jane Kelly finds Edwin not criminally responsible, he will be detained in hospital. If she convicts him of murder, he'll be sentenced to life imprisoned. Psychologist Stephanie Penny, who met with Edwin earlier this year, testified Wednesday that Edwin had reported not taking his medication for many years, but that he also said he wasn't experiencing any symptoms, which Penny said would be atypical, if true. There is reason to think that that probably wasn't the case for Mr. Edwin, that he was in fact not symptom-free for those years, Penny said. Due to Mr. Edwin leading quite a socially isolated life, it's my opinion that he more likely than not was symptomatic, but was not coming to the attention of mental health professionals for a number of years. Calls grow for release of skills fund ratings. Union chief says lobbyist Tory links among reasons recipient scores should be made public. Pressure is mounting on Premier Doug Ford and Labor Minister David Piccinni to release evaluation scores for all organizations awarded money from the controversial $2.5 billion Skills Development Fund. In the wake of a STAR analysis revealing 17 labor and industry groups that endorsed Ford's progressive conservatives in the February election got $237 million, the Ontario Public Service Employees Union and others are demanding the ratings for all recipients since the fund's launch 4 years ago. Piccinni has refused to release the rankings, despite an Auditor General's report 2 weeks ago that criticized the government for a lack of transparency in how money was granted, particularly to organizations that hired lobbyists and whose applications were scored low to medium. We believe that the government should release the scores of every single one of those recipients, not just the unions, OPSEU President J.P. Hornick said Thursday. This is also about those with direct ties to the government themselves. Piccinni's office did not reply to a STAR request for an interview with the minister on Thursday. OPSEU has long accused Ford of diverting training money from struggling community colleges, but emphasized some unions that received funding and endorsed the Tories are using the money effectively. The government's refusal to make the scores public undermines the importance of skills training and casts a shadow over the program, said Liberal MPP John Fraser from Ottawa South. If I was a trade union right now, I'd be pissed because the government has used this file in a way that drags them into it with all this other crappy stuff that's happening, Fraser said, adding it's unclear to him how Pacini can survive in Ford's cabinet. I don't know how he can hang on to it. NDP leader Marit Stiles said the problem is not with the fund, but with a government that has no respect for taxpayer dollars. Among the 17 unions and groups that endorsed Ford in the February 27th election, six hired consultants with Tory links to approach the Minister of Labor, according to the Integrity Commissioner's Lobbyist Registry. That includes Rubicon Strategy, headed by Ford's PC campaign manager, Corey Tenik. Hornick said the lobbyist Tory connections are another reason the evaluation scores should be made public. Do we have a government that is handing out literally billions of dollars in taxpayer money out of a slush fund in exchange for political endorsements or as a reward for friendship? Hornick said. This government, since the Greenbelt, has really lowered the bar in terms of our expectations about them not being corrupt, Hornick said, referring to the $8.28 billion land swap scandal under investigation by the RCMP. In a blistering 42-page report 2 weeks ago, Auditor General Shelley Spence found 64 organizations whose applications were ranked low and medium and hired lobbyists to press their case with the ministry shared $126 million in skills funding. That was not fair, transparent, or accountable, she wrote. To date, 549, or 54% of applications approved for funding by the minister's office were ranked poor and got $742 million. The minister's office rejected another 670 applications that were ranked high. It's difficult to determine if any of the organizations that endorsed Ford's PCs or hired lobbyists had an advantage because the scores remain secret. Several recipients of funding told the Star they were never informed of their ratings. Applications are not provided with that information, Tom Cardinal, President and Chief of Staff of the Carpenters Regional Council, said in a statement to the Star. Ford defends the fund as one of the best programs we've ever put together, saying it has trained more than 700,000 people for jobs in the trades amid a shortage of skilled workers. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 17th, that's today, issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Linda Lover. Thank you for listening.